sights to show you.
Smoke from bongs.
Yeah.
And then I've never smoked hash before until that moment.
Never again.
And never again will I. But no, it was just bad. It was a bad time all around. This is all being recorded, so
Let's kick it off. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Sorry to my family members who have to listen to me discuss my blatant recreational drug use.
Yeah.
Family members.
I'm sure our audience members appreciate it because there's
but I know my family listens.
Oh, your audience members are just gonna be like, you smoke with your family?
They're like, yes, bong stories, please.
Anyway, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome everyone to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster, and as always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Anthony Fuentes.
Yo.
And as a special guest, we have my wonderful betrothed human being. The return of Deca Jordan Spears. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yay.
Also, happy birthday.
And happy birthday, yes.
Thanks.
We were going to have DJ on the episode that almost was, but wasn't quite there.
Yeah, we were too dead. That's yeah, horrible thing. But we're not dead yet. Well, right now.
We're doing pretty good. So we're doing pretty good. Today, we are talking about a film that is near and dear to DJ's heart. DJ actually picked it out.
Good fucking choice. I haven't seen this. So this was nice.
DJ picked it out. I've only seen the one vignette that, of course, everyone and their mom has seen.
The one that's on the marketing and
shit? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Anthony hadn't seen it, but I really liked it. You've seen it in the title. You know we're talking about it. We are talking about 1975's Trilogy of Terror.
Going back to the 70s, yeah.
Really excited. 70s horror.
Back to back.
Back to back. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, we did the 70s last week with Carrie. Thank you, everyone, for your love and support on that.
Yep.
So much fun.
A lot of fun. I like that one a lot.
So thank you for that. So let's go ahead and jump right in.
Yes. Okay. So as always, we start with our fat ass IMDb synopsis. It's interesting. I noticed that for all our Black History Month films, these are one sentence. but now that we're just doing regular movies, they're just like, no, here's a whole thing. So let's go. Three bizarre horror stories, all of which star Karen Black in four different roles playing tormented women. The first follows a college professor who seeks vengeance over her date rape. The second is about twin sisters who have a bizarre relationship. And the third focuses on a woman terrorized by a Zuni fetish doll in her apartment. Those are pretty accurate.
This is actually a combination of two different ones.
The what?
This is a combination of two different synopses.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So the first one, the first sentence was three bizarre horror stories. That was one. And then the second one was another one that I found, and I was like, okay, I'm going to combine these.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. So, the IMDb could still be stupid. That makes sense.
So it's not entirely, it could just be me.
Okay, which is Alex's creativity right there.
I could just be a racist person.
Well, I mean, it was a Zuni fetish doll, which... I'm actually Zuni.
Oh,
on
really?
On my mom's side. So I was like, this seems inaccurate. But anyway.
We'll get into it.
We're gonna learn some shit today. Hell yeah. Okay.
But yeah, so...
This one stars... here's the cast list per segment. So the first segment, Julie, stars Karen Black as Julie. And Robert Burton as Chad Rogers. Jesus fuck. Okay. The second segment is Millicent and Therese. It stars Karen Black, of course, again, as Millicent / Therese. Spoiler alert. And then John Carlin as Thomas Aman. And then George Gaines.
Gaines.
Okay, I'm just gonna keep saying Gaines as Dr. Chester Ramsey, and of course the last one, the one that everybody knows, Amelia, stars Karen Black as Amelia! Yay! So yeah, and then of course someone else, Alex, go ahead and give us who did this bitch.
So
who did it?
This film was directed by Dan Curtis. It was produced by Dan Curtis and Robert Singer of Supernatural fame.
What?
Wow.
Hey. Okay. Actually, some authenticness would be appreciated.
That is how I am authentic in my surprise.
I've never seen Supernatural. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It wasn't for you.
Yeah. The audience was different.
I threw that in there for DJ because DJ has a Supernatural tattoo. So.
Oh, shit.
Yes, I do. Don't judge me.
But the writers for the film, so this is actually a very interesting kind of hodgepodge of how they divvied up writing for this.
Huh.
The teleplay for this was it was written for Julie and Millicent and Therese, was written by William F. Nolan. Richard Matheson wrote the original story for all three.
Of course he fucking would.
And then he adapted, I believe, which is the one that I didn't mention, Amelia into the teleplay.
Huh. That's the most, like, I feel like, Twilight Zone-y one?
I agree. Well, I don't know if I mentioned this in here, but Amelia was designed to initially be a one-act play.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It is a simple story. So
yes,
it's very
simple. It's supposed to be a one-woman, one-act play. The film was first aired as an ABC Movie of the Week on March 4th, 1975. And as of now, there is no budget information available for the film.
Wait a second. This was a fucking movie of the week?
Yes.
Oh, this is a lot dark. This is pretty dark for a movie of the week.
Is it ABC for family?
No. So this is like notoriously one of like the creepiest ones. So there was some actual like censorship issues that people were like concerned about. But yeah, this was a movie of the week.
This is some heavy shit for a movie. Wow, 70s. All right, cool. This is like early TV too. Yeah. So yeah, okay, that makes sense.
When I was going through like articles for it, most of the things, like a lot of people brought that up, how it was like definitely one of the most creepy movies of the week, especially for something that came out in the beginning of March.
Yeah, and there's blood in this movie. Mm-hmm. And there's like sexual assault.
Yeah.
It's fucking okay, cool, good to know. But I'm learning today, guys, just so you know. All this shit's new to me. Fun.
Yeah, so we are going to go ahead and dive right into it. Of course, the iconography of this film is most notably the performances of Karen Black.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would be amiss if we didn't talk about this film without, of course, talking about her. So DJ is going to take us through a little bit of her history.
I am. All right. So Karen Black was born as Karen Blanche Ziegler in Park Ridge, Illinois, in suburban Chicago on July 1st, 1939, to a family of creatives.
Hmm.
Her grandfather being a musician and her mother being a successful children's book author, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a lot of good influences to pull from.
She has a lot of creative juju going on.
Oh, yeah. And her acting in this film was pretty great.
I agree.
Pretty great. And she had one sister, actress Gail Brown, who predominantly starred in the soap opera Another World from the mid-70s through the mid-80s. For Karen, her film debut was in The Primetime in 1960, and her first big role was in You're a Big Boy Now in 1966, which was directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Godfather director.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm like, that name looks familiar.
Yeah, Francis Ford Coppola.
Perfect. Kind of one of the most important filmmakers ever, actually.
So. All right.
Coppola.
Coppola? Caputo?
That was my fucking...
Ebert?
Ever.
That was your fucking... Yeah, one of the most important film critics also, just like...
Which,
Ebola?
By the way... Which, by the way, going through this, Roger Ebert does come up. Because he's like my man now. Yeah. I went through like an extensive Wikipedia like time suck just Googling Roger Ebert.
He's got a good life. He's a very
fantastic
interesting fella.
Life. There was a quote that I went through and it made me think about my own life extensively. So I'm like...
Oh, you should see his documentaries. It's tragic, though.
I'm sure.
Yeah, because
tragedy.
It's the last years of his life.
Or particularly fucked.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Oof. Anyways, back to the movie.
Yeah. E. Coppola.
All right. Directed by Francis Ford Coppola, beginning in 1967, and she appeared in guest roles in several television series. And let it be known that over her lifetime, Karen Black has almost 200 film credits. She was actively working up until the year or so that she passed away. So we don't have a time to go into her entire filmography, but it is pretty extensive.
So this was a mistake on my part. It was within 2 or 3 years of her death.
Oh, okay.
Because she did become pretty ill in the last 2 or 3 years before she passed away. However, I got this confused because in the year or so, I think a couple months before she passed away, mm-hmm. she was invited to a film premiere. It was the last film premiere of River Phoenix. His last film that was filmed in like the 90s, obviously, before he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a little cameo in the film, so she was invited to the premiere, but she couldn't go because it was in Sweden. And she was very, very sick.
I thought the way you were starting that sentence, and she was very, very racist.
No.
It was just the
inflection
there.
Why do you always
have
to make everything about race?
Yeah, Alex.
No, not at all.
I was talking about you, Anthony.
Anyway.
I want to say, with these 200 film credits, though, basically of her time, she was like the Danny Trejo
era. It's actually, you make a great point in terms of like B-list cult horror. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. That like, sounds like it.
It's exactly right.
Oh, all right. Karen Black was the Danny Trejo of back in the day. That's awesome.
I fully support this.
She also did a lot of like art house type of stuff.
Oh, okay. So she's like
not necessarily like grindhouse, like you know Trejo, but mm-hmm. you know.
I can't think of another actor. All right, joke dead.
And moving on, in 1970, Black appeared opposite of Jack Nicholson in the film Five Easy Pieces, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress and earned her first Golden Globe Award for Best Supporting Actress Motion Picture. She also won a New York Film Critics Circle Award for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in the film.
Damn, go Karen.
Like, yeah, right off the bat.
She's just, like, making moves, and I'm like, yes.
Well, also, just being such a strong actress, immediately, like, opposite Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Like, literally in the 70s.
And this is post One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, too, so his mm-hmm. star is hot at this point.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And she's able to hold her own against Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Badass.
She's a powerhouse.
She is the Danny Trejo of her
time. Yeah, exactly.
So Karen's first real breakthrough came in 1971 when she earned yet another Golden Globe in the same category for her role in a 1971 rendition of The Great Gatsby.
That's the one with Robert Redford, right?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, okay. That one sucked.
Well, she earned a Golden Globe, so fuck you.
No, she was okay. Sucked. Yeah, the movie sucked. That was Redford's most just
but
like, I'm going to stand
Black
in frame. He was coasting, all right?
And then in 1975, Black starred in Trilogy of Terror beside her then husband, Robert Burton.
Oh, yeah, by the way, the date rapist was her husband at the time.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. They were married for a year.
But, okay, that they played contentious very well with each other.
You know, I'm pretty sure they were bringing in some real life things.
I think so.
Gotta make it authentic.
Yeah, they were married for like a year and a half.
Yeah.
And like, anyway, we'll get into it.
That adds a lot. Holy shit.
Oh, yeah. There'll be more.
They didn't get married over the course of the filming. They were married before.
Yeah, prior to.
So, anyway.
From there, she gained a reputation for being a cult horror icon, and within the next year, starred in another Dan Curtis film, Burnt Offerings, which is in 1976, and Alfred Hitchcock's last film, Family Plot, in 1976. Black's later career emphasized numerous horror roles as well, varying in obscurities. In 2003, she was featured in Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses as Mother Firefly, which is a fact to me that is new because I did not know that.
Yeah, so she plays Mother Firefly in the in House of a Thousand Corpses, but not the Devil's Rejects. Because at that point, I think she just wasn't interested, or she was doing other things. I'm not entirely sure.
Or she's older, and she's like, I just want to like live my life now.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Although, I do love Mother Firefly in the Devil's Rejects.
I wasn't a fan of House of a Thousand Corpses, so I probably wasn't paying much attention. But I feel like I now have to go back and like rewatch it.
This is actually pushing me towards you.
I'm like, gotta watch it for Karen. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
Were her and Danny Trejo ever in a movie together?
I don't know. You know what? I'm sure.
There has to be. There has to be one.
Can you look into it?
Oh my God.
I will. Would you like me to look into it right now?
Just save it. Let's keep going. Okay. Yeah, we'll get there.
All right. So after her final films were released in 2010, she was diagnosed with cancer and stopped making public appearances. On August 8th, 2013, Black died in Santa Monica, California at age 74. Actress Juliette Lewis paid tribute, saying, "Karen Black was my mentor and a second mother to me. She inspired everyone she came into contact with."
That's so nice.
It is.
I adore Juliette Lewis. I do too. I included that in the thing, even though I didn't have to. I was just like, I feel like I need to, because I really, really love Juliette Lewis.
I need people to know this immediately.
I feel like just Karen Black being a mentor to Juliette Lewis makes me love her more.
Well, it also explains a lot, because they also do look very, very similar.
They do. Very similar. All right. And later in her life, Karen Black would admit Trilogy of Terror is the film that firmly cemented her into B-horror iconography, saying, "I think this little movie took my life and put it on a path that it didn't even belong in."
That's interesting, because, she was, like, opposite Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. Well, because she did a lot of, I was looking at, like, the films that she was featured in before this, and she was in a lot of, like, she was in comedies, she was in, like, dramas and, like, mysteries.
Oh, yeah.
But she was never in, like, outright horror. So I think that's really, really interesting that, like, this really just, like, pretty much made her be typecast for the rest of her life.
I mean, this is, like, when television's starting to be in every home. And, like, there's literally, like, three channels and some cable. So, like, this movie, like, she's probably, this is the biggest audience she probably ever had without even getting an official number on it. So people are like, that's the horror girl right there.
Exactly.
My question is it still even the real Karen Black, or is it the Zuni Warrior doll?
Who knows?
Oh, my gosh. That's when her career changed right there.
Exactly.
Yes, I'll sign up for these roles. But then now we get to talk about the fantastic writer of this, who's written a lot of amazing shit. We've already done episodes that have had his touch in there.
Yeah.
I think twice at least.
At least.
Yeah. So we're talking about motherfucking Richard Matheson, who's just a badass. But let's go. Okay. So Richard Matheson was an American author and screenwriter, primarily in the fantasy, horror, and science fiction genres. We can thank Richard Matheson for a slew of important contributions to horror, such as, these are really good ones, I Am Legend, The Shrinking Man, A Stir of Echoes, Hell House. Matheson also wrote 16 television episodes of The Twilight Zone, including Nightmare at 20,000 Feet and Steel. Steel was the, they turned into a Hugh Jackman movie later on.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like Real Steel or some bullshit. It sucked. he adapted his 1971 short story, Duel, as a screenplay directed by Steven Spielberg for the television film Duel later that year. That's the one with the cars we were talking about before. Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to make it into the final cut, but yeah, we were definitely talking about it earlier.
Duel happens to be Steven Spielberg's full-length feature film debut.
Yeah, so.
And that was 1971? Nice. When was that?
Duel?
71 was the short story.
That was the short story. Yeah, okay, you're
71,
right. 71,
yeah.
So Duel was probably just a little bit after that. But man, he was so close to Jaws. He was within, like, like, right there. Okay. According to film critic Roger Ebert, our boy.
So, there's a TV broadcast and a theatrical cut. But, yeah, it was released November 13th, 1971.
Oh, okay, cool. So, it was nice. Later on. That's that fast turnaround from back in the day. Which, if you want to talk about fast turnaround, our last episode, Carrie. Directed by Brian De Palma. More plugs. Sorry. According to film critic Roger Ebert, again, our boy, Matheson's scientific approach to the supernatural in I Am Legend and other novels from the 1950s to early 1960s, quote, anticipated pseudo-realistic fantasy novels like Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist. Stephen King has listed Matheson as a creative influence, and his novel Cell is dedicated to Matheson, along with filmmaker George A. Romero. Romero frequently acknowledged Matheson as an inspiration and listed the shambling vampire creatures that appear in The Last Man on Earth, the first film version of I Am Legend, as the inspiration for the zombie ghouls he envisioned in Night of the Living Dead.
Literally, dude. This is just like influence, like upon influence upon influence. Like you're talking about all of these intensely influential figures in horror, just like basically just like praising each other and admitting how much they admire one another, which I think is personally
that's
so
badass.
I
love that. And it's like a lot of this shit came from his fucking imagination.
Yeah.
And it's horror iconography at this point, which is fucking insane.
Here, we're gonna cut like the me turning it around, but I'm gonna show you guys his list of works.
Oh, is that Matheson right
there?
Yeah,
this is Matheson's list of works.
Okay, she's still scrolling, guys. She's still scrolling. Holy fuck!
Wow.
we didn't even get to television. Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Damn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's how I want to be one day,
right?
Yeah. So he has an extensive. He has a certain sense of prolific writing. Like he has a writing habit that.
Oh yeah.
Because he has a couple of like my favorite stories. Also,
he does.
He's done a bunch of short stories. He's done, you know, the novels to like I Am Legend. He did Stir of Echoes, which of course was adapted into a film that I know DJ adores.
There was a contemporary version of that, wasn't there?
Stir of Echoes? Yeah, it has Kevin Bacon in it.
Yes, yep. Kevin Bacon. Okay, that's what I remember in it. Yeah. All right, that makes sense.
An interesting movie.
But yeah, wow. I know. Like, Hell House, you know.
Dude.
Yeah.
Fucking A. Okay.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I mean, with this much material, he's bound to influence somebody at some point.
Or influence everyone.
Or everyone, yeah. Because look at those Twilight Zone episodes. God damn. They're all up over here.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. He worked on the movie, too, which is where we, the last time we talked about Matheson fully.
Oh, yeah. He worked in segment 4, which was...
That one, which one was 4? That was the, fuck. It was good.
Was it?
Pretty sure it was good.
It wasn't Anthony.
No, that was the...
Third
second
one.
To last. Nightmare 20,000 Feet.
Duh.
Yeah, the most iconic fucking one. Okay, keep that in because we're idiots.
For some reason, I just kept thinking of, like, definitely not John Landis.
Yeah, not the Landis one.
And then it wasn't Anthony, and then it wasn't Kick the Can.
Although, It's a Good Life is his story, though.
It's a Good Life?
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool. But also, that makes sense because Spielberg also worked on It's a Good Life.
Yep. No, Spielberg did Kick the Can.
Oh, yeah. I got the names confused. But yes, I was thinking of Kick the Can, but
I haven't seen Twilight Zone.
The movie?
No.
Oh. Awkward.
You'd like it.
I
feel like I would. I just never put time into it. I don't know why.
I think you should watch it. Did you ever listen to me talk about anything affiliated with the movie?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay,
so you know about the tragedy and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, then maybe...
Yeah,
okay.
You might be able to stomach
then
it then.
You should be able to watch it, because I watched it without really knowing.
I can also just stomach a lot.
Yeah, I feel you.
I gotta adjust.
We did the killing of America, after all.
Well, I think, because, like, I remember, and this is just me being, like, just me reminiscing at this point, but we watched it... Or I watched it without the context.
Yeah.
So I think it made it particularly fucked up.
So yeah, she liked the story with the fucked up context a lot. But, and I was like, no.
He also worked on Jaws 3D.
Matheson worked on Jaws 3D?
Yes.
Can't win them all. Okay.
But he did also work on I Am Legend from 2007. Like he actually...
Huh.
I love I Am Legend.
I know you do.
I just wish the CG was better.
Yeah.
Okay, but back to the last Matheson fact here. Anne Rice stated that when she was a child, Matheson's story, A Dress of White Silk, was an early influence on her interest in vampires and fantasy fiction. So he's definitely been an established and influential figure, which if you haven't listened to us gush for like the past fucking 10 minutes, this guy...
The amount of gush.
He dropped his balls on horror. He just,
I kind of just want to say, like, Anne Rice is one of my biggest inspirations for my interest in vampires and fantasy fiction as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of like, damn, am I like also influenced based by like Matheson?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I'm like, now I feel like I need to look into all of his
stuff. You should. Because, well, yeah. I mean, if he and I think, because, okay, here's the thing. Roger Ebert also is like very like, he was super analytical and very like scientific about everything. Mm-hmm. So I think his praise is very apt when it comes to Matheson. So I like that he appreciated that Matheson had a very like
analytical way of
analytical scientific way, mm-hmm. but also a very creepy like supernatural way that also appealed to someone like Anne Rice,
yeah,
who doesn't have the same scientific kind of like
I want the scientific blah, 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 blah.
Right.
I want all the blah, blah, blah.
So I think Matheson is like a perfect mix of the two,
mm-hmm. yeah, and he does both really well, which is why people pull what they want from
exactly because he's done sci-fi and horror. So
by the way, Anne Rice, my mother loves.
Really?
She loves it. I would see Anne Rice books all throughout my house.
You know what's all so funny? I just have the context of Anne Rice like suing fan fiction authors.
Oh, she does?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she doesn't like, she hated people writing like basically
her characters.
Yeah, writing like fan fiction with her characters and like sued people over it.
Oh my
god. So basically you're not allowed on any fan fiction site to use or write any like Interview with a Vampire like fic. It's very interesting.
Oh, we got to get into some Anne Rice down the line. There's got to be an Anne Rice episode in there somewhere,
like,
somehow.
Like, she sued them. Like, it was this whole thing. It's very interesting, and I don't know a whole lot about it, but that's all I know, because I remember, like, being really confused onto, like, why on, like, certain websites. It was, like, you can't have, like, fan art or anything, like, depicting any Interview with a Vampire type stuff.
That's crazy.
I really want to look into that, just because I... Also, just coming from a creative writing background as well, like, I was never a fan of fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, part of me is like, I understand why Anne Rice would sue people.
But as somebody who works in marketing, I'm like, let them gush your shit up. Let them push it.
Yeah.
Because but then, you know, she's already getting people to buy fucking paperbacks anyway.
But also, she has so many, like...
It's totally her choice. I get that. I just think it's so funny because it's very similar from my understanding of the interpretation of events. It's very similar to, like, Metallica suing, like, Napster.
Yeah.
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 Like,
that's not how things work. Are you running on hard times right now?
Huh?
I was like, are you just running on hard times right now?
Well, no, it was just like Metallica suing Napster for like streaming their music illegally. Like, it was just like, just for propriety's sake, like not mm-hmm. necessarily like, you know?
Yeah.
And I get it. It's, they're totally within their right of doing it. It's just undecidedly like not metal.
No, it's not. But then again, Metallica's like, they've had those interviews where they're crying and talking about each other's feelings. That's not metal.
Okay,
either.
some kind of monster.
Or is it really metal?
Yeah, some kind of monster is... Kind of, there's some mixed feelings I have about some kind of monster, for sure. But anyway.
All right.
Let's move on.
Let's go.
We took a hard left into tangent territory. Let's rein it back in. So now, we haven't actually talked about any, we haven't really had a section about any of these kinds of things in films before, but I saw a couple when I was doing research, so I thought it'd be fun to talk about a couple production facts and goofs.
I think with TV movies, you're going to get a lot more goofs, because there's not a lot of oversight
there. Yeah, there was a lot more goofs where it's like, you can see the microphone in this scene, in this scene, and I was like,
Nah, we want the good goofs.
But when the film was first shown on Brazilian television in March of 1981, censorship demanded that the third segment, Emilia, was completely cut.
What the blazes?
Yeah. Because of this, the TV station was forced to change the Portuguese title to Duas Histórias de Terror, which is two horror stories.
Huh.
That's like,
Duas Historias de Terror.
That's like not as fun as saying Trilogy of Terror.
Yeah. Two horror stories. Take it or fucking leave it.
You want one horror story? Keep it up.
Horror.
Weren't there three? three, who are shut the fuck up.
Well, now its title is Uno.
Uno scary.
When the doll latches onto Amelia's neck and Amelia, her screams do not match her mouth. I noticed that and I teased the TV relentlessly.
Oh, really?
I yelled. I was just like, what the fuck?
I just, in my mind, I was like, 70s.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing. I mean, a similar thing did happen for me as well, I must admit.
Yeah, you just kind of let it go.
Yeah, you kind of, yeah, it's true.
You just gotta.
Yeah. In the first segment, Julie, when Chad goes to get a room, he uses the fake name Jonathan Harker, a name taken from the Bram Stoker novel Dracula.
Not Bram Stoker, the porn fucking actor. Or Notorious Fluffer. Oh, God. Can someone get Bram Stoker here? Roddy's getting soft.
I'm burning my headphones.
She took them off, audience. I hate this.
I'm never recording again. I can never. I hate it. Because I always make the most unfortunate, mess up and I say the worst things and then Anthony says something funny and I can't cut them out.
It's like it's 90% turns into a dick joke. 90%.
Given who I am.
Are you a real podcast if you haven't made at least one dick joke?
You're right.
You know how many dick jokes have he's made?
Oh, a lot.
Probably a lot less than Bram Stoker, though. That guy, that guy's a goddamn machine.
You could have just killed me. I was drinking.
I know.
You could have just killed me. I could have just spit soda. And then all of our equipment would have just perished.
No, it would have been like in Carrie when like the electricity hits the guy and he just like floats backwards with like that. Like if anybody watched wrestling back in the day when The Rock got rock bottom, like, he got the Stone Cold Stunner and he did like two flips backwards, that would happen to Alex and
Anyway, so the hotel room, by the way, cost $15, which is $85 in today's money because I checked.
Jeez.
Which is real steep for what looked like to be a seedy as fuck motel.
Seriously.
Well, I mean, of course, for the things that took place after.
Right. But also, like, I think, like I didn't understand why he looked so peeved at first when he was like, $15, what are you trying to do, rob me? And I was like, why is he so upset? It's $15. And then I Googled it and I was like, oh.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Because it's 15 whole dollars. That's why. But also, the sodas that he got was like a dollar.
Yeah.
So, can't be mad at that.
I mean,
and I did Google that, and that was like still $5. And I would be so happy if I got two large sodas at the movie theater.
For $5?
For $5.
Dude.
So I'll let that go.
I mean, he kind of evened out. If he went to the movies nowadays and bought a cheap hotel, it'd be roughly the same price.
Exactly. Imagine those movie tickets.
Oh my God.
The idea of grinning and showing fang-like teeth similar to the Zuni doll, and the final and arguably most chilling image of the film actually came from Karen Black herself. It was her idea.
That's how she cemented her career right there. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Way to go,
which
Karen.
Is really cool, and the fact that they listened to her was also really cool. Yeah, Karen's idea for the mom and the daughter to have like point for their relationship to be a point of contention.
Interesting. Mm. Okay.
Yeah. The original Zuni doll puppet was owned by director Dan Curtis and was used for the new sculpts of the Zuni doll in the sequel Trilogy of Terror 2,
also good.
Is it?
Is it?
I kind of want to try to watch it now.
I haven't seen it, so I can't confirm or deny.
I say watch it.
How does it compare to this one?
First one's still better.
Okay.
But I also like the first of most things I like better.
Yeah. Plus this, I mean, this is just it's just a very well-made movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
I love when, like, the two of y'all like movies I recommend that you haven't seen yet.
Yeah, because they blow us away. Again, audience, just if you hear noises, there are pets around, and we need a bigger mic setting for the three of us here, so...
You're gonna have to deal with being in my living room.
Mm-hmm.
In part two, Millicent removes a book from the shelf labeled Voodoo and Satanism. Not only is it misspelled, but the title has obviously been written on the book by hand. So I love this also because, like, Millicent is also, like, very, like, she's a Satanist and voodoo and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, she's just... she just likes having fun.
Yeah, yeah.
She's just a little party hardy.
She enjoys a drink or two, and she likes some dark entertainment.
Who doesn't? Yeah. Who doesn't?
I did that shit last night.
And maybe this morning.
Shut up. We're just a part of the conversation.
But yeah, so it's just, you know, what the voodoo also just, it's just all of it being spelled wrong. It's just hysterical.
Just so you know, audience, the shut up was an inside joke in jest. That was
No, you're telling DG to actually shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're so rude.
Whatever.
I thought we were friends.
You asshole. Okay.
Plane's gone.
It's like Halloween 2.
It is. It's exactly. Oh, keep that in. That's awesome. For more on that reference, defer to our episode of Halloween 2 just 2 episodes ago. Also, a little bit of time in the 70s was spent there. We've been all 70s this month.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Lots of 70s.
Lots of 70s. Sorry. Not next week, though. Spoiler.
Oh.
Next week's 90s.
Anyway, so when the doctor removes the wig from Therese Millicent's dead body at the end of part 2, she moves her head on her own.
Of course she does.
So, yep. And then also all the remaining goofs were just like dumb shit. Like, you see a microphone, or she moves on her own, or, you know, dumb shit.
Oh my god, she's breathing. She's supposed to not be breathing. Why is she breathing? Ah! Fucking IMDb.
Or like continuity errors with like the Zuni doll, like that kind of stuff. But there was a fun production fact. Karen Black, it was also her idea for the Zuni doll to cut her thumb, and she had the production guy put fake blood on her hand, and she just hit it while she was trying to grab the knife, and then when it was time for her to actually get cut by the knife, then she was able to just like smother it on her hand, so she was able to do it in one continuous take.
She had a hand in this. Hell yeah.
Yeah, no.
She should have been a director.
She actually later in her life was a playwright.
Oh, okay.
Oh, she came from a family of creatives.
I told you.
She learned creative fucking solutions. Exactly. Way to go. Yeah, nice.
So, the reception of Trilogy of Terror. So, normally we have a production section with at least something, but literally nothing. I could find nothing. There was nothing other than they filmed in LA in the winter of 1974 to 1975.
Boo. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
But on Rotten Tomatoes, this film holds an approval rating of 91% based off of 11 reviews.
Damn.
So, impressive.
Impressive for a TV movie. TV movies don't get shit.
Yeah. Jeremiah Kipp from Slant Magazine awarded the film 3.5 out of 4 stars. praising the film's direction, script, and Black's performance. On Black's performance, Kipp wrote, "Black plays a female protagonist in each story, and she's the kind of extreme actress who not only acts with her eyes, the face, but with her neck, her fingertips, her elbows, wrists, and torso. Gusto is not the word."
Damn, she actually does, though. She's she's like in this.
Yeah, no, she's a head-to-toe type of actress, for sure.
Way to go, Kipp.
Felix Vasquez of CinemaCraze.com felt that the first two segments were, quote, forgettable, and stated that only the last segment was, quote, truly entertaining and creepy. Concluding his review, Vasquez wrote, "Trilogy of Terror was an all-around disappointing film with a steady focus on psychological torment and less on actual terror or scares. I wish I could join along with the crowd and praise this film, but I would have had to have been entertained to do so."
Jesus, Vasquez. You son of a bitch.
I would be amiss if I didn't at least include some dissenting opinions.
Good point. But he's wrong.
The Zuni doll probably crawled up his ass.
Megan Navarro from Bloody Disgusting included Trilogy of Terror in her list of, quote, 10 scariest made-for-TV horror movies, praising the final segment as keeping the film forever at the forefront of made-for-television movie memory, which absolutely correct.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because, the last one, I know we'll get into it, but it does have a certain level of iconography to it, which it does cement it that hard. But I will say, like, the other two segments don't slouch. They don't slouch to me at all.
There's so much, like, flack that the first two get for being forgettable or just not entertaining. I think they're perfectly entertaining.
I think so, too. Yeah. Okay, we'll get to it right now. Let's see, we got one more fact. Yes. One more fact.
Trilogy of Terror has developed a cult following over the years and has well-earned its reputation as a cult classic. As we previously mentioned, it also helped establish Karen Black as a standout performer in cult horror films.
Good.
So. close.
Way to read, yay!
I can read! But yeah, so that is Trilogy of Terror, and now we can finally discuss the actual film itself. So I'm actually really excited for this because I've seen the I've seen Amelia several times in my gender and film my gender and horror film class.
Really?
In college, yeah. So I talk about this class all the time.
Yes, for this podcast. Is obviously very fundamental for your understanding of this podcast.
Yes, definitely. So I took a gender and horror film. It was technically gender and film, but the professor that I took it with made it all horror. Like, the theme of the class, because it was all horror.
Thank you, Professor. This is why we have this fucking podcast.
Yeah. It was Professor Bundy.
Oh, of course.
He was actually really, really cool. He has actually since passed away, and I'm really sad about it.
But nobody investigated his cabin at all.
But, no, it was super influential for me, because that's actually what got me into Cronenberg.
Yeah.
What got me into a lot of, this is when I first saw Antichrist. Like, I saw a lot of, like, really influential films because of, I saw It's Alive, I saw a lot of films that I've actually recommended on the podcast.
Nice.
Because I was there witnessing class. A lot of.
The books that I have is because of that class, because it was required material, so.
So you witnessed the growth of the horror obsession, just, like, take
I mean,
over.
Like, I definitely think there was a growth in the horror, because a lot of what Alex tends to like is, you know, true crime stuff. And we've had conversations about this, how, like, your family likes true crime stuff, and my family is on the horror bandwagon.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting seeing, like, this blossom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can share everything!
Like, I liked horror before, but, it was all very contemporary. Like, and then I think that class really cemented my appreciation of the classics.
Well, it expands your lens for looking at it,
definitely.
Which is a good class will expand your lens on any topic.
And yeah.
That's good. Way to go, Bundy. Rest
Thanks,
in peace.
But yeah, so it was a very influential class. But anyway, let's go into some discussion of the film. So which vignette was your favorite?
DJ first.
My favorite, and I feel like you are expecting me to say Amelia.
No, I'm not. Oh, really? Because Amelia is not my favorite.
Okay. Julie's my favorite.
Julie's my favorite, too.
Is Julie the first one?
Yeah.
Julie's my favorite also.
Yeah! So now we... But why?
Okay, right.
Oh, okay. Julie, to me, is the most sophisticated one of the bunch. It's fucking really well done. It has a very dark, horrifying subject matter, and it actually turns it on its head kind of out of nowhere, but the twist makes sense, and I totally dig it.
Yeah, it has a really great, like, I spit on your grave type vibe to it that I really appreciate, and I think that especially at the time, like, I know at that point I Spit on Your Grave had been out, but I think it told a good story, and it had, I think, especially by the time it came out in 1975, that there was a twist to it that was, like, I don't think anyone really would have seen coming.
Yeah, I mean, you're really invested in this character as the victim for, like, 90% of the fucking story.
And then it does a complete 180.
Oh, yeah, it gives her the goddamn power. But then also, like, this one, I think the first one, well, they all have their own, like, kind of category here. So the middle one to me is, like, old Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very, like, classic kind of story.
It's mystery.
It is,
And it has that, like, mystery thriller to it.
And it's in one room, so it's like a bottle episode also.
For which one?
Oh, no, it's not in one.
No, it's not in one room.
No, it isn't. You're right. I'm wrong. Yeah. The third one is. But yeah, and then the third one's a lot more contemporary.
Yeah.
Which is why it stands. It's a lot more like what you'd see in an 80s film. But this one is, like, 70s exploitation with class, which is fucking hard.
Yeah.
That's really hard. That's a Carpenter move right there. Like, straight up.
No, yeah. I think that one, I think it was definitely my favorite in comparison to the rest. I wouldn't say Amelia is, like, my least favorite. I think it's just because I've seen it so many times. Like, it's, like, it's so overhyped that it's, like, I feel like the first two deserve recognition.
Yeah,
I think that they, I don't think that they're done poorly. I think that they're all done really, really well. I really personally enjoyed Millicent and Therese, like, just because I mean, I kind of saw the ending coming, but also, like, at the time, if I had seen this in 1975, I don't know if I would have.
Maybe. You're holding your britches.
Yeah. clutching my pearls or whatever.
That is an orange skirt. What?
Yeah, or, you know.
See, I think Julie, for me, is my favorite because I just want to know more about her character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because she mentions, you know, well, in Colorado, you know, I got bored with this person really quickly. And it just kind of tells, like, she... And then at the ending, when she's putting things in a scrapbook, it's like, oh, she's been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if there's this, like, you know... I'm wondering if she's taking revenge on students in general. Like, if she has actually experienced assault by a student.
Mm-hmm.
If she's just kind of, like, now this femme fatale of, like, must murder all men.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, is it also, like, is there a supernatural element to it?
No.
Mm. No, it seems a lot more practical, to be
honest
with you.
Yeah, I think Amelia is the only one that has the supernatural anything.
You think?
Yeah.
Because,
well, actually,
I wasn't sure, because in the first one, because she's just, like, basically, like, she quotes what he said in private to his friend, verbatim.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure if it was, like, I thought she was, like, a succubus, or at least that's what I wanted it to be.
Oh.
No, you're right, she's a total fucking succubus.
Yeah.
She is. You get a good revelation right there, because, yeah.
So that's what I interpreted her character as.
Well, see, that's the thing. Like, this first one, they give you enough information, but also withhold enough to where you're it makes you ask questions. Like, and you're more intrigued as the character what the whole thing is, because they throw the twist towards the end, but there's it's such a complex wave to make sure that it pulls off. It somehow pulls it off, and it leaves the complexity for you to figure out. But you want to, because it's a very intriguing story. So
yeah.
It's just, that's just good filmmaking right there.
I agree. But no, the middle one, like, I think it had good points. I think it just, I think in comparison to the other two, it just felt kind of...
Bland.
Bland?
Yeah, it's a little bland.
For Millicent and Therese?
Yeah, I feel like that one was missing something.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, that one was also very, like... predictable.
Yeah. I agree.
Like, it was predictable.
Well, here's the thing. Is the multiple personality, like...
Trope
has been used so often since.
Yeah.
That for us, like, we're conditioned to anticipate that. The second I don't see siblings in the same room, I'm like, oh, they're the same fucking person.
Yeah. That's a fucking wig. That's a fucking wig.
Yeah. And then, you know, so it... And then also, which is, like, just stark, like... obviously, like, such stark personalities, like, an opposite personalities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like, oh no, she's matronly. Oh no, she's wearing a tight tank top. They must hate each other. Oh no.
Oh, she never leaves the room when I'm here.
I'm wondering if Millicent and Therese are actually, like, the real person, or if they're both personalities.
Oh, I don't know. I think they address this.
They kind of do, but I'm still kind of...
The,
like,
Wikipedia page addresses it, but they don't address it in the movie.
No.
Again, one of those things that fans are just like, well, we need answers, and it's been like 40 years.
So,
we're just going to write it in there.
We're just going to type it up ourselves. Anyway, moving on. The third vignette is really what propelled this film into cult classic territory, in my opinion, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Feel free to disagree with me.
It's on all the promo art for everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
This was definitely, like, the highlight of...
Mm-hmm.
This
yeah,
it's the fastest one too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about it in comparison to the other stories really makes it stick out so prominently, or what, in your opinion?
DJ?
So I kind of want to throw out the whole, like, they're using a Zuni, like, warrior doll as the main plot. And I think back in the 70s, people probably were like, oh, that's something exotic, or, like, that's different.
Oh, yeah.
So I think in that time, that definitely helps. I think it's interesting because you see Amelia kind of just running and screaming away from this character that you never really get, like, a clear view of from.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of like a mystery. It's like, how is this thing opening fucking doors and chasing after this woman and doing all of these things? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, there's.
Ooh. Yeah, I think it plays on the fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And plays off of this, like, idea that there's something, like, monstrous about like Native American culture specifically.
Yeah.
Which is something, again, I am Zuni from my mom's side. And yeah. And I think now I didn't recognize that until like I got older.
Mm-hmm.
Or like watching it now and I'm just like, oh, that's not right. This isn't accurate.
Well, to bring it back to one of our previous episodes, actually, because we covered this time period, it was for The Killing of America. A lot of the films, the Mondo films and things like that, these audiences were drawn to it because of that. Because it was other cultures, other things unknown. And these were based in reality.
Yeah. And it was exotic.
Exotic. Yeah. And yet, but it was exploitative. It was straight up just like, well, yeah, it's foreign and it's scary and it's different. I'm not bothering to understand it. But it's for my amusement kind of thing. Which I think there's definitely a bit of that. Even though this is a narrative film, it's one that's really vicious. So it still plays into both of those kind of appeals that Mondo films and films that explore other cultures in a very exploitative way do for audiences at the time. Like, it's a selling point.
Yeah.
Which I think is probably why it sticks. And, of course, the Zuni doll itself is fucking terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
It's scary.
The Zuni doll has gone to live in, like, again, horror iconography. Like, everyone, whether they've seen Trilogy of Terror or not, recognizes the Zuni doll.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that, like, people, like, mass-produce the Zuni doll. Like, you can buy little figurines of the Zuni doll.
I'm gonna get it tattooed on my leg.
Why?
I'm not. I mean, I would also add just, like, Karen Black's, like, decision of having Amelia's character at the end have the teeth of the Zuni doll and kind of presenting super barbaric. I think that's also something that makes that last story so iconic, because it's like, that's an image. Like, I will never forget that image of her, like, with the creepy smile and just, like, stabbing a knife into the floor.
And this is pre-CG. So this the teeth effect looks good.
Yeah, because they're practical.
It looks fucking horrifying. And the knife. Because you see this knife cause so much damage to her body in the fucking 10 minutes or 15 minutes the segment is.
And it's like this big.
Yeah, yeah. The little kitchen knife that I used to cut steak with back in the day.
Which, by the way, when, like, the funniest moment in the whole fucking film is when our little Zuni guy is like shanking under the door and just like shaking the knife around.
Okay, so I was just, Alex was like, hey, look, it's Toriel.
So our cat, and anyone who has cats can relate, literally our cat will, whenever we're in the bathroom, will stick her hand under the bathroom door and just wave her paw around. Try to get under. So anytime, like, so when we saw that in the movie and he was just like, stuck his knife around, it was just like, ah!
And I'm just thinking about how my cat does that and tries to get my toes. Like, listen, fucker, especially if I haven't cut her nails and they're sharp.
It's like their little knives.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing, basically.
So it's just really, the Zuni warrior doll is actually just a very aggressive cat.
Is it like, yippee, beep, 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 like that? Is it making little fucking noises, your cat?
Basically, yeah. If she's super hyper, she'll make little chirpy noises. Just
oh
like,
my gosh, bah, bah, bah. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, fucking A. Well, that would make this a little more terrifying.
You've clearly never had a cat attack your feet
I'm a dog.
In the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Come from a dog family.
Yeah. Our cats have attacked my feet in the middle of the night when I try to move them to get comfortable, and you just feel like something grab your foot.
Oh, yeah. I just like to move my toes at
one
night,
day,
and she's just like, yoink.
One day a demon is actually going to grab my feet. And
okay, we're not going to talk about that.
I'm going to be.
Because I have experience.
And I'm going to be totally unfazed because I'm so used to the cats just attacking my feet.
This little demon under the bed's going to be like, aw. Like the person from Hollywood Horror Nights.
It's going to be this demon's first day of work. Just like, okay, I'm going to scare this person. It's my first time. And I'm just going to be like, Britannia, go away.
You're like, fucking demon.
Poor demon's
going
to go cry to their mom.
The fucking elder demon. Like, I thought, like, no, listen, you're just not good. I'm sorry. You get one chance, you know? You should have had it.
You fucking blew it. Really, it's just because I'm used to cats attacking my feet at all hours of the night. Anyway, moving on.
No, wait, but why do you think, though? This third segment, you didn't get into it.
Oh, for me? I think we kind of talked about it earlier. The first two were kind of already established horror conventions.
Mm-hmm.
With the third one, it was kind of new.
Yeah, that's true.
When we also have this one room, this one
it's like a
room,
bottle episode, yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, because there's, and it's also, again, very Richard Matheson, you know, because it's like one room, one character, which we see time and time again in Twilight Zone episodes that he's directed.
Characters in the middle of a story, too. Their own personal story.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's not really a narrative, like, it's in the middle of their life narrative.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a narrative within a narrative, so it's like a side quest.
One other thing about this segment too that I want to emphasize, because I just learned it's a TV movie and I didn't know that watching it, and now looking back at it, even though we had the date rape story and then we had of course classical whodunit or mystery fucking this one is bloody, and it's bloody in a very weirdly like not Hollywood-y bloody kind of way. Like the blood looks like blood and it sticks to her fucking skin like kind of natural. That probably freaked people the fuck out on TV.
Sure. Yeah. Like, I mean, this is playing in like the evening on like the in an early, you know, an early March day. Like people are not anticipating to be fucking terrified in this, because the first two definitely have like those like thriller mystery type that like a traditional you know, thriller or mystery of the time would have.
Yeah.
So, like, the first two, those would make sense because they have the drama aspect to them.
Like an episode of Quincy.
Precisely. And for to understand that reference, listen to Halloween 2.
Halloween 2, yeah.
For, and then
we're
the
plugging
last,
today.
You are. Yeah. For the last one, it's truly just horror. Mm-hmm. Like, and, like, just no, like, it's just horror. Like, there's no, like, real, you know, thriller, mystery, you know, anything else really attached to it other than just a classic scary story.
Well, that, and also think about it, Killer Doll. Killer Doll media at this time, what do you have? Talking Tina, she, you know, she killed somebody by them, like, tripping him down the stairs.
Yeah.
This Killer Doll furious.
Yeah, this is 75.
75. What else was out around that time, Killer Doll-wise? Because we got Child's Play in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Late 80s, too, at that. Like,
let me check, because I think I know some.
No, definitely pull it up.
No, because, I think, like, Dolls came out at that point, right?
That's what I was thinking. Like, I don't know if that came out in the 80s.
Dolls
or the
70s. Was like,
See, but then Dolls wasn't a TV movie. You would just seek that shit out. This was thrust upon audiences who had three channels.
I agree.
Dolls was even, that was late 80s.
Okay.
Yeah. So you think about it, this is an evolution of the Killer Doll kind of themes, because you give them a knife, you give them motion.
I agree. I'm disappointed that we didn't bring this up during
during what?
During any of our Talking Doll or Killer Doll series.
I didn't see this movie. This is DJ. You brought a revelation to us right now. See the discussion.
But this is why your recommendations are so important.
Exactly. And audiences, if you guys have any recs, you know, feel free to DM us. Some of you do.
Yeah, and we love them.
We do. We appreciate it every time.
Anyway, so all of these stories center around stories of women in some kind of distress. Do you feel like this was intentional or just kind of how these stories ended up becoming?
I think they cast Karen Black.
Enough said.
They're just like, there's conflict in all these stories. She's the central thing, so yeah.
There's no, like, overarching, like, storyline necessarily where, like, they all have the common theme.
No, nothing tying together.
Other than, like, women in distress. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it. Like, that's truly the only, like, something bad happening to women. Like, whether they're the villain, whether they're, you know.
I think I would think, like, all of them are women in distress except for Julie.
Yeah, because
I think in some ways, like, she knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, she played it up.
I mean,
she's technically in distress, and we think she's in distress until, like, literally the last 5 minutes.
But we think she's in distress, but she's not, like, actually
but
in distress.
I mean, for the sake of advertising, they can't say...
They can't reveal the twist.
The story of three women in distress except for the last 5 minutes of one of them. Like, you can't advertise that.
Because are you sure?
Well, that, but if you really look at it, you're right. The story itself, for most of it, is a woman in distress.
Exactly.
The punchline, the way it concludes is not.
Exactly. And the whole time you're watching Julie, you have sympathy for her.
Yes.
You feel bad for her. Mm-hmm. You want to help her.
She's like the Famke Jensen character in The Faculty.
Yeah.
She's exactly that fucking character.
And then, I love Julie through the entire segment, even after the twist.
I agree. No, same here. Totally. I totally was just like, fuck yeah. Like, that's what he deserves.
I love her more after the twist. I'm not fucking choosing date rape guy. But, I almost got her. Sorry, bro.
Well, also, his name was Chad, which also just had a certain level of, like, 2019 irony behind it that I just couldn't help but laugh at.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I think that, I think that there's, I appreciated that character because she is set up to make you feel sympathy
mm-hmm.
and feel bad for her and want to take care of her. And then to learn at the end that she knew exactly what she was doing the entire time.
Yeah.
So do you think this film would succeed in a modern retelling on either television or as a theatrical release? Either of you?
Netflix. Netflix Trilogy of Terror.
So. Yeah, I could see that.
Mm-hmm.
You think a Netflix, like each episode, like would you say like 30 minute, 45 minute, hour long episodes? Like,
I mean, it would just be, I would see it as a movie.
Really? Just like a movie, Netflix like a movie. Netflix original, like Trilogy of Terror?
Like they would play it up as like a callback to mm-hmm. the old one, and they would probably have very similar style stories, but 3 30 minute segments, I think.
Well, yeah, because each one's like 20 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you want to see like the original stories?
No, I want new.
You want new ones?
I want new. Although, give me the Zuni doll again. I want the
You
want doll.
To see it featured, or like, do you want to see it as like in the like in like? Let's see. Well, let me paint you a picture.
All right.
Our protagonists are walking into an antique shop,
mm-hmm.
and they're looking through piles and piles of just junk, and then they come across the Zuni fetish doll, and of course they look at it, and the main character is like, why would anyone want to buy this piece of crap? And then chucks
it's not even PC.
Yeah, chucks it or something, but basically like it's there, but it's not like people think it's going to be a main focal point, but it's absolutely not, and it's just like there for a brief moment, and then it's gone.
Mm. But that's some good scene setting right there.
Thank you.
I think that would work. I like the idea of just, like, discarding this essential thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then I can also see, like, they throw it out the window, and then it, like, it's, like, among the city. It's, like, babes in the city, pig in the city, like, the same thing. Like, it's the same with the Zuni doll.
But Zuni fetish doll mm-hmm. in the city. It's, like, Sex in the City, but, like, Zuni fetish doll in the city.
It's, like, at the end of the segment, it's in, like, a tiny suit with the briefcase. Just, like, roving, like, wants a job. It, like, wants it, and it's, like,
Today on the Horrible People's Podcast writes a horror comedy again.
Yeah. I'm down for it.
The Zuni fetish doll job.
I feel like it would be cool to also see it as something similar to like.
I just imagined it in a suit. I'm so sorry.
A little Zuni doll in the suit. Sorry.
Oh, this poor thing's probably like working in a corporate office and is like an underpaid worker who gets yelled at.
I know.
He's like about to stab his boss, but then he's like, gotta pay for rent. He comes home from work
after a long day, and his wife and kids are just like, Dad.
Nah, dude, he's swiping, and he's not getting any attention, because he's a fucking Zuni doll. Like, except the weird girls, he's just like, fuck.
Or it's pretty much all horror nerds who are just like, you look real familiar.
Every date, they're like asking, like, so did you like take over? How did you get back in your body? He's like, I can tell the story like 10 times.
It's like, have you seen that episode?
I feel
episode
like we're
of...
setting a really great, you know, story plot.
I think so. But what episode? What?
I was thinking, have you seen the episode of Rick and Morty with the, when they're jumping from dreams and they get to Scary Terry?
Yes.
And then Scary Terry at the end of the day, like, goes home. That's what I imagine with the Zuni doll.
Exactly. I love that. But I think he would be totally living the millennial lifestyle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he'd just be like, wanting to stab his boss, like, intrinsically. But then he's like, I could stalk Doug, because Doug never refills the ink in the copier. And he's useless.
The ink in the copier?
Ink in the printer.
In the printer copier. Yeah.
Okay, I was just like, the copier?
I don't know. I don't print things. But yeah, that would be a really cool segment, because at the end of it, no matter what murder he does, I still want him walking down the street, like, around a bunch of way bigger people.
But with his little suit. If anyone decides to write this...
If anyone steals our fucking idea, I will find you, and I will kill you.
when you're the marketing executive for Marvel.
Yeah,
remember I cut that out in the beginning.
Well,
boo.
Yeah, so this will be a full-length feature film eventually.
Yeah.
Amelia takes the city.
Amelia takes the city. I love that.
Like it heals.
I know.
We're having too much fun with this.
Okay, gotta move on. Okay, I do want to give this as an opportunity for any scenes or moments in any of the stories that stood out to you in particular. Any moment or anything that you want to gush about, this is your opportunity.
Dude played a real good date rapist.
Oh yeah. Robert Burton or whatever his name was. Yeah,
a little too well.
A little too well. like really fucking believable.
He was real creepy. Also, when when the movie first started and it was that vignette, like mm-hmm. DJ and I were both just like, first of all, this is the weirdest looking college class I've ever seen.
Yeah.
To the point that I was like, this isn't high school. He looks like he's 47.
True. No, and it's weird because it's like, she's having fun seeing how dark other people get, and like, he wasn't dark enough, and he was pretty goddamn dark in this one. Mm-hmm. So I was like, holy shit, she's got some tastes there.
I wonder if he was like, played it so well because they were married.
Yeah,
maybe, but then also yeah, but like then in a very tumultuous marriage too that ended really soon afterwards.
By the way, Karen Black and her last husband, because she was married 4 times, they were active Scientologists.
Oh,
cool.
Interesting.
Interesting.
But that was just my fun fact.
But any scene sticking out to either of you two, like just in particular? To me, I'm just like, the performance of the date rapist was really like, again, terrifying.
Yeah, I think for me, I truly think her performance as Julie is like mm-hmm. standout for me.
Yeah,
she has that like old school like 1950s like
Elvira
kind of coming back at you at the end.
Parts mm-hmm. of it are also almost like Audrey Hepburn esque.
Yes,
that I appreciated,
mm-hmm.
that I liked. But yeah, what about you, DJ?
I just I echo what you were saying, just Karen Black's performance as Julie in general. And I think for me, it was also just like when that twist comes around and there's that really quick like shift in personality.
Yes.
Where she goes from like she goes from playing this, you know, innocent person who was like being held against her will mm-hmm. to like, okay, I'm bored.
Like Famke Jensen from The Faculty. Yeah. Probably the same fucking
thing. What episode is that, 11?
No, that was even earlier. That was like one of our earlier
ones. 9?
Yeah. That was like 6 maybe.
7? Oh, okay.
Yeah. I wasn't actually planning to plug that. That's just, I think, a comparison. That really
you
is.
You made a reference twice, so yeah. I figured you were going to make it and turn it into a reference. But
no, it was, I honestly think that's probably how they wrote that character. Like,
I'm sure.
It really makes sense.
But, all right, cool. All right, for my last question, and feel free to throw in any other additional questions when I'm done. But what would you change about any of the vignettes? Because I know we all appreciate the film and really, really do enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But what would you want to see done differently?
Put the little guy in a suit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I want him in a, like, I just keep thinking this is the vision in my head. Again, no, but
I'm going to have a dream tonight about that.
Yeah. but no, I mean, in terms of the segments, I guess I would have, like, a completely different filmmaker do the second one. So they can make it, like, more entertaining and more, like, Hitchcockian, maybe.
Yeah,
because
maybe,
it doesn't have, it has a...
I wanted it to be a little bit more like Rope.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. it's honestly, it's the most TV of the segments.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't like that.
That's what I was thinking, too. I would want a little bit more substance out mm-hmm. of the second one. That's my only real criticism, is just, like, some more substance.
Do it in, like, do, like, just one day of all this stuff happening. Do it like Rope, where it's all one fucking shot. And somebody's coming in and out.
Mm-hmm.
It is Karen Black being a different person every time. And, like, make it a whole fucking thing. Get real auteur with it. I think that would have made the second story very engaging the whole way through.
Yeah.
But it needs a flair that the other two had for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But the middle one
didn't.
It was too, like, I don't want to say, like, normative. But it was, like, almost too, like, you know, normative for
the
time.
It really was. Yeah, exactly. Standard. It was
standard
as fuck.
Yeah, it was super standard for the time.
How about you? Change?
I agree with just adding a little bit more substance to the second one. Because, again, the first one with Julie is my absolute favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And then Amelia, I think, has done really well. But the Melisande and Therese is just very, like, it's lacking.
It's not bad.
Yeah, it's not just... bad, and I still enjoy it, but it's definitely lacking in comparison to the other two.
It really gets overshadowed. Yeah. That's the only issue. And it's in the middle, too, so it's typical middle child syndrome right there.
Just... Oh, yeah, and I do think it would do really well if it were a longer, like, standalone
thing.
Like, I think that would do really well as a standalone.
If it was given, like, a proper, even, like, a movie, like, if it was given, like, a proper movie treatment... Where it had proper time to flesh out the characters, where we got backstory on Millicent and Therese, like what if they were both twins, or what if they were actually twins, and like one of them died, and then like what if, like if we had actual substance and story to both characters, I think it would have been a really awesome, promising story. But because you only have 20 minutes to tell such an intricate story, it just there was a lot missing in my opinion.
I think there was a lot of complexities to that story that there was just no time to actually flesh out everything.
They kind of gave you the obvious answers when the story needed to.
Yeah.
And without any like flair. It was just straight up just like, and isn't that fucked up? Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I agree.
And then also, I guess, maybe some, like, not, I didn't like the Zuni doll, like the close up. They did that too much.
Oh, the close-up of, like, that.
I understand the technology wasn't there, so they probably couldn't... Because there are times where I'm like, are they just holding the bottom? And, like, and like running it across the camera? But, yeah, the when it gets too in its face, it becomes less scary, like, the tenth time they do it. So, you know, maybe a little more...
That Zuni doll ran really quickly.
It did.
Yeah, it's fast little fucker.
God, and I swear, my grandma had that knife in her fucking thing with the wooden handle, and like,
I think everyone's grandma. Did.
Yeah, everybody's grandma cut thin little steak that she overcooked with that fucking knife.
I think also get sturdier gold chain to keep spirits into the doll.
Oh yeah.
Like literally, like she
put it down.
She put it down, and it just fell apart. It's like Dollar Tree chains. Like I don't. Anyway, I think that's actually a good place to stop. Does anyone else have any final thoughts, comments, questions, concerns, other than let's put our Zuni man in a suit?
Fuck. That was one of my big things I was going to reemphasize. But I will say, if you are listening to this and haven't seen the film, sorry for spoiling Julie. That actually we should have told you up top, because that's one you got to experience without the spoiler. And it adds to the story.
We've been lagging with the spoilers.
I mean,
at this point, you guys know we are not a spoiler-free podcast.
No, definitely not. I mean, yeah. But
so if you're listening, you did it to yourself.
Yeah.
Although, again, a lot of our audience...
Also, this movie came out in 1975. You've had your chance. I mean, your time.
True. I mean, you two just saw this full film for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. And I would not have liked Julie's spoiled for me, actually. I feel like that is a good experience to have...
It's true.
On its own. So again, if you could just like forget what we said too, watch it.
Just men and block yourself.
This is not the episode you want to listen to.
Just men and block yourself and go back and, you know, leave a little note. Watch Trilogy of Terror.
Or DJ just did a Jedi mind trick right now. So just keep that in mind.
It is streaming on Amazon Prime. So go ahead and watch that. DJ and I had a really nice weekend just watching 70s horror films, which is
another shameless plug. Since we...
No, you can't tell them because we're going to have to talk about it.
Oh.
Well, I do want to do that at one point, though.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the movie, so you can't talk about what
I will wait until
watch.
You see this movie.
Okay, good.
And then I need you to text me your reaction to this movie.
I will totally do so because I do love my 70s horror, and they just recommend me one that like they both lost their shit about. So.
Well, and here's the thing. I immediately thought of Anthony when I saw it because I know how much you love 70s horror, and the fact that I liked it.
I know, that's why. That's why. And a slasher, too. That's why I'm like, all right, cool, I can dig
it. These are just like... This movie and the one that we recommended you are just like movies I saw very young in time. Mm-hmm. We've talked about how I see a lot of movies when I was younger.
Yeah,
and they like, I have scenes of them as I've been an adult that just pop up and I'm like, holy shit, what was that movie called? Because it was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And so like seeing it, like I think I had just run across that film after we watched Trilogy of Terror and I'm like, ooh, click.
Yeah.
I know that scene. It holds up,
But no, it was really good, and you should definitely watch it.
All right, cool.
Anyway, I think this is a good place. We can just wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. That was Trilogy of Terror from 1975, directed by Dan Curtis. Thank you for joining us, DJ. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
And happy graduation. Congratulations on getting a master's degree.
Jeez.
Thanks to all of the listeners out there. You can donate to my Venmo at @Deka_Spears.
Oh, you're going to get charges.
Yeah. But no, thank you for joining us.
Oh, real quick though, next week we go to the early 90s and we get a sequel. We're doing a sequel.
Yes.
To something that terrified the fuck out of me. Probably even worse than the first one.
We're doing something fun. It's going to be great. It's going to be a good time. And then for the rest of May, we have some cool shit planned.
Oh, we have a request fulfillment, actually, at the end of this month.
We do. But, not only is it a request fulfillment, but also it's something... It's a classic.
It's a classic.
It is a classic. It's one of the few horror films I was allowed to watch as a teenager.
And one more thing. Guess what? It's still in the fucking 70s. What?
Yeah, we accidentally went very 70s this centric month.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
month.
May was 70s month for some fucking reason. except next week's film.
Well, I support it. But that's because next week we're hitting the 6-month mark of a very, very special movie.
Yep,
so
that's a good point.
That's why we had to stray from our accidental theme.
Mm-hmm. We gotta do what we gotta do. Right.
I think y'all are giving out a little too much information now.
It's okay.
Yeah, we're fine.
That's okay. We don't mind spoiling it because usually if Anthony's really excited, he'll start posting...
way ahead of time.
Way ahead of time.
Don't worry.
It's fine. We don't really care that much.
You're not a spoiler-free podcast.
We're not a spoiler-free podcast. That's absolutely correct.
All right.
So thank you everyone for joining us. Please, if you like what you heard, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. It boosts us up on the charts and it means the absolute world to us. We got a really, really fun review this week and Anthony texted it to me. It made me chuckle.
Oh, it was very creative.
It was very creative. They did, instead of saying rosary, say rosemary, which did make me giggle.
That I do like that. Again, we've heard this many times. I didn't realize how many of you actually don't watch horror films, but listen to our podcast. You are our heroes. And then you people who do, you guys always are on Instagram, and we appreciate that too.
Oh, yeah, we appreciate all of you for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. But yeah, 5 stars on iTunes. If you have iTunes, it absolutely means the world to us and makes our day. So thank you for that. Please subscribe, do what you gotta do, wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to find us on social media, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on Twitter at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORROR BLE, People's Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Horror People Pod. You can find Anthony on Twitter and Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop.
But how do you find DJ, Alex?
I don't know. Where can we find you, DJ? Because I know you're private on everything except for Twitter, which is Deka_Spears.
See, I forget my Twitter handle all the time.
That awkward trans kid.
Yes. So you could follow me on Instagram at That Awkward Trans Kid. And on Twitter at Deka_Spears. And I am usually not on Twitter, but if you follow me, then I'll try to be more engaging.
Yeah.
Anthony's been saying the same thing since we started the podcast.
See, I get to the point where I tweet and I'm like, nah.
Also, casual shout out to my friend Beatrice, who I've known since high school, who started listening to the podcast.
Yay.
And just realized that it's done by my fiance. So
apparently she's been listening forever now realized.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Hi, Beatrice.
Hello.
But no, thank you everyone for joining, for joining us. Please, do what you gotta do.
Someone crowdfund that Zuni in the City. Please.
Yeah, please.
We would really love to see the little suit.
Oh my god.
The briefcase.
I would love it.
He drops a briefcase and a spear falls out and he's like, oh shit.
Imagine him on a bad day and it's raining and he gets splashed by a car driving.
Oh, and he falls into the gutter and he's trying to no. He's doing his little shuffle too and it's not working.
Guys, we need to make this. We need to make this happen. Whoever's listening happens to be a multi-millionaire and wants to make me happy.
Fund this bitch.
Fund this.
And pay my student loan debt.
And mine too. It'll make the podcast easier.
But no, thank you everyone for joining us. Have a fantastic week and we'll catch you next week. Until then, have a good time out there, horror.
Stay scary.
Yeah.
Stay scary. That's
stay scary, you horror bees.
Horror bees. Peace out, you motherfuckers.
Bye, guys.